Welcome to the UFO Files, and online we have Stanton Friedman, and Stanton is talking to us from his home in Canada, where you said it's going to be, what, 6 below tonight?
No, 6 above.
Oh, okay. Well, I
should... with wind chill, it'll be 6 below.
Well, throughout the southeast and the east, and here in Oklahoma, we have a little snow on the ground as well, so I guess winter is here.
Yes.
I wanted to talk to you about several things. I know you're into an interesting new project we want to get into in a minute. We always have a lot of fun and enjoy our conversations with you. But first of all, I don't guess you get the sci-fi panel, the channel up there in Canada, or do you?
No, the U.S. sci-fi channel is not shown here in Canada. I was able to get my son over in Maine to, I live in New Brunswick, which shares a border with Maine, to tape the Roswell program, and I did pick that up, and I've watched that.
Yeah, but, well, the reason I asked that, because I wanted to make sure, I mean, they said a couple of things about you, and I guess you were actually interviewed for the program as well.
Well, not quite. No, that interview they used is about 5 years old.
Okay.
Couldn't afford to bring me in, I guess.
Yeah, they I thought the narrator went a little out of his way there to kind of knock the MJ-12.
Well, I thought so, too. That was one of a number of concerns that I have. I am so sick and tired of people calling that a hoax. These are the armchair theorists. I've been to 19 archives. I've written a book and several papers, talked to the families of the members, and I have also identified a number of the last generation of MJ-12 documents as frauds, by doing careful investigation, not by doing proclamations. There is a difference between the two, and there are ongoing discussions which illustrate that. Let me give you one silly example, kind of. It's been proclaimed by two different people who had been in the military that all top secret documents have top secret control numbers on them. And since the MJ-12 documents, the Eisenhower briefing document, the Truman Forrestal memo, and the Cutler-Twining memo, none of them have top secret control numbers. Obviously, it's a fraud, they say. When you look more deeply, as I have, I even published a couple of top secret documents without control numbers in my final report on Operation Majestic 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys are talking usually about military communications rather than National Security Council and Council and White House stuff. They're not the same. The rules are different. I talked to three different archives, Marshall, Eisenhower, and Truman, and that's General George C. Marshall.
Yes.
And all of those three said we didn't always use top secret control numbers. As a matter of fact, the archivist at the Marshall Archive said, Stan, if they had to use top secret control numbers on every top secret document, we'd still be fighting World War II.
Yeah.
So, but here are these guys making pronouncements. That's just a typical example. Another one is on one of the documents, the security marking is top secret restricted. It's on a one-page document that was found in the National Archives, the only original document we have. I mean, we don't have it. The archives have it. You can
take
it out.
Right.
And that is an unusual security marking. But the General Accounting Office, buried in its big report about Roswell that they did for Congressman Steve Schiff, mentions that on December 7th, 1994, I guess it was, they were looking at somebody's files up through top secret Air Force files, and they didn't find anything about Roswell, but they noted several instances of the use of top secret restricted, even though they had been told that it was not in use, Majestic 12 in parentheses, at the time. Now, I talked to the three GAO people who were involved, and I said, hey, how do I get copies of those? And they said, they were still classified, Stan. We couldn't make copies of them. And now I got people saying, well, if you can't produce them, then they don't exist. I mean, the GAO's word isn't good enough, you know. So I get a little disgusted with some of this stuff. You spend all this time and effort and energy, and some guy sits in his armchair and finds fault. And I'll listen to everybody, but you know, let's provide a basis. You know, it was like Phil Klass paid me $1,000 for proving him wrong about the typeface on that duck.
Yeah, we talked about that in detail in one of our previous shows.
Yeah, I mean, generalizing from 9 pieces of paper to 250,000, they all had to use the same typeface, you know. And this is silly. And I get other guys saying those documents are phony because the date format, 18 November, 1952, violates the government style manual. Well, I had one file folder that had 7 different date formats. I published in my 1990 report 3 different items from the Director of Central Intelligence to Ike's office, his military guy, within a 2-week period, and they had 3 different date formats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is one wrong, one right, and the other 2 wrong? Of course not. It depends on who types it, and these are all limited distribution, classified documents written before the Freedom of Information Act that nobody expected would ever see the light of day. Who cared, you know?
You know, your book about that is still selling well, and a lot of people are still reading it. In fact, we have a link on our website where people can go buy it.
Good.
And, it's just kind of interesting. I thought the narrator, and I don't know his name. I'm sorry, I didn't watch the show. I was working, but I was told that he pretty well just put you in there with the alien autopsy.
Yeah, in one sentence, another fraud was, you know,
yeah,
just like that. And I, as a matter of fact, I felt a little bit like some of those Russian politicians who were airbrushed out of pictures after they were eliminated.
Yeah, yeah, they didn't even bother to do a new interview with you. They just picked up something out of the past. Carl Flock, you know, you guys had had that interesting little debate up there in New Mexico last year.
Yeah, well, that was several years ago.
and the interesting thing about Flock is he seemed to be all over that show, so I don't know.
Well, yeah, I don't know what went on. I don't know why, who decided what. It was mentioned that I and Len Stringfield had originated the Roswell story, or and that isn't true. I started it. I told a guy named Steve Toms in Chicago where to find Jesse Marcel, and he talked to Len Stringfield. So I was there first. Len knows that. I mean, he's dead now, so he knew it before.
Yeah, right.
But you know, there were a number of strange things on the show. Why do they keep showing these large polyethylene balloons for Mogul? You know, these huge things, teardrop-shaped things?
Mm-hmm.
They weren't used for Mogul before the Roswell incident. They used a string, as somebody said on the program, 20 to 25 standard, normal neoprene weather balloons that you used to be able to buy in surplus stores. And it makes a difference because the neoprene went out in the sun for a few days, it turns into dust practically. And, you know, it loses all its strength. There were, they showed a picture, one of the good things in the program, it's not all bad, was Dr. David Rudiak analyzed or provided his analysis, his reading of the Ramey memo. There's a picture of General Roger Ramey, head of the 8th Air Force, who was the boss, if you will, of Colonel Butch Blanchard, who was the head of Roswell and head of the 509th. Ramey is shown in his office with the phony balloon material. I mean, it's real balloon material, and it certainly isn't Mogul balloon. But in his hand, he's holding a piece of paper that's folded over. And in one of the few pictures that show the piece of paper, the others you can't read it. I mean, the backside is showing. But there's one where you can see that there's print on the paper. Now, these were good quality pictures taken with a good press camera, one of those old 4x5 speed graphic kind of things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so you blow it up, and I had scans done of the original negative, both sides, and of the several other prints that had been made over the years. I first found the picture 23 years ago. And David has managed to read it using very good software and using, now you got computerized lists. If you know the second, fourth, seventh letter, give me all the other English words, all the English words that have those letters.
Mm-hmm.
And so that restricts your choice pretty heavily, you know. And so that memo, which talks about victims of the wreck, and is apparently from General Ramey to the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General Hoyt Vandenberg, would seem to prove that there was a crash, despite what the nasty, noisy negativists keep saying.
Yeah, now, you told us the story about getting turned onto this down in Louisiana at a television station. When was that, 1977 or something like that?
78. 78. It was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And, you know, that story is still important because we still have people claiming, as the Air Force did, that the story came to light when the National Enquirer carried an interview with Jesse Marcel, who had gone to them saying he'd recovered wreckage of a flying saucer in 1947. And also in 78, UFO researcher Stanton Friedman met with Marcel and started looking for other witnesses. Now, we've just tabloidized the story.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is that there was an Enquirer article 2 years later, and by 1980 when that came out, I gave the Enquirer reporter Jesse's address because the reporter had done some fine articles and because the first book was due out, The Roswell Incident by William L. Moore and Charles Berlitz, and Bill and I did 95% of the research. I even got a cut of the royalties, which proves something or other. Anyway, everybody keeps saying Marcel came forward. He never came forward. He wasn't looking for publicity. He didn't run to a tabloid. One academics-oriented book says, of course, you know the Enquirer paid for such stories. Hogwash. I was at the television station in Baton Rouge. I was doing a lecture that night at Louisiana State University, and I was supposed to do three interviews at this one television station for three different programs. You know how it goes in mm-hmm. TV stations.
And sure.
I had done the first two, and the third reporter was nowhere to be found. She was late. And the man who managed the station, Johnny Allen, he knew the person who brought me to the station, and he knew that I had other things to do. And he's giving me coffee. We're making idle chit-chat. He's looking at his watch. He's embarrassed, frankly. You don't know where she is. And that was before everybody had cell phones, you know. And while we're sitting there, out of the blue, he says, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. Who's he? Oh, he handled pieces of the wreckage of one of those saucers you're interested in when he was in the military. This is with nobody else around, with a very straight face, clearly serious. And I'm shocked, and I said, well, tell me more. What do you know? Well, he lives over in Houma. I didn't know where Houma was, of course, but I've been there since. And Louisiana. Mm-hmm. It's actually a pretty good-sized town, 100,000 people, I think. Anyway, he's a great guy. We're old ham radio buddies. You ought to talk to him. Well, the reporter then showed up. So the next day from the airport, because I was busy all the rest of the day, I called information. There was a Jesse Marcel listed in Houma. I talked to him. He tells me his story. He doesn't have a date. He's not making a big deal about it. He knew Johnny Allen. They were indeed old ham radio buddies. And he tells me his story, but without a date, how am I going to check on it, you know? A few months later, I'm in Bemidji, Minnesota, at the college, now it's a university there, and after the lecture, two people come up to me and ask quietly, had I ever heard of a crash saucer in New Mexico? Well, yes, I had. They told me their story. Their good friend, Barney Barnett, had told them about stumbling across a saucer with bodies this time. Jesse said nothing about bodies. And they didn't have a date. I got their name and address and passed that on to Bill Moore. And he had a third story. An English actor driving across the United States had heard on a radio program, he was going from L.A. to Philadelphia, about a crash saucer in New Mexico. Nothing about bodies, and they weren't talking alien spacecraft. It was a flying disc, which was kind of a generic term for stuff that was strange and moving around in the sky. And he could pin down the date. He thought it would be a big story when he got to Philadelphia. There was nothing. because it was not a trip you made very often. You remember, well, late June, early July, 1947. Bill went to the University of Minnesota Library, looked in the periodicals department, and the newspapers of July 8th had the story. In other words, we did it the old-fashioned way, dog work.
Yeah, I understand.
And that gave us a whole bunch of names. And it verified what Jesse had said, incidentally, which was kind of neat. And by 2 years later, Bill and I had talked to 62 people in conjunction with this event. So it had nothing to do with Jesse seeking fame and fortune. I certainly never paid him anything. And the Inquirer didn't either. And we had that was before CD-ROM phone books, you know. So my phone bill used to run $400, $500 a month. Just trying to track people down. Somebody would say, well, I remember Joe Jones. He was there. The last time I heard, he lived in Oshkosh, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to try to, you call information, and you call the library to get the city directories. And it's just a lot of work. That's all. It pays off. Any good reporter does that sort of thing. But I strongly resent the idea, you know, that Jesse came forward, decided to, there was a television movie that made that approach, too. One of the strange things, too, I was dismayed that they showed Roswell newspapers. How about showing a front page of the Chicago Daily News, big paper, the front page of the Spokane Chronicle, the front page of the Los Angeles Express, Army captures flying saucer, General thinks it's radar weather gadget. That one had both stories because the cover story came out 6 hours later. And it's more impressive to people. I mean, they say, oh, small town paper, who knows, big deal. They also soft-played, there was a guy named Frank Kaufman mentioned on the show. And Frank was a key witness of, an important witness of Kevin Randall. And, well, it turns out Frank was a fraud. I mean, he faked documents, he did other things. And so they sort of soft-pedaled that, well, maybe now we can't trust him. But Carl Flack had the nerve to say, everybody's, the whole Roswell thing is dependent on Frank. His name isn't even in my book, Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident. It was Kevin Randall's guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I had raised objections, as a matter of fact, to give Frank credit. He died in 2001, last year. And in an interview back in 95, he claimed that he had gone across the mountain to White Sands missile range there and was watching on radar and got a call. He saw a light, something exploded on the screen, and he called over, and somebody at the base is over 100 miles away, looked up north, and there was something had come down up there. So Frank comes traipsing across the mountain, mm-hmm. 100 miles, wakes up Colonel Blanchard in the middle of the night, the base commander of the only atomic bombing group in the world, mind you,
mm-hmm.
And wakes up Major Marcel, the intelligence officer, and they all traipse north to the site away from the debris field that we knew about, in the middle of nowhere, in a military vehicle. They saw the bodies and the wreckage, and they called the base, and a flatbed truck came out, and by morning it was all gone. Now, that made no sense. Colonel Blanchard, as head of the 509, certainly wasn't going to leave his post without knowing what the heck was out there. He'd wait. I mean, if it was one of his B-29s with a nuclear weapon on board, sure.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what's there. And Frank said, well, they didn't have any spotter planes when I asked about that. And I found out they did have spotter planes. In addition, Major Marcel would certainly not have reacted the way he did, sitting at the base on that Sunday, when the sheriff called him to say this cowboy had come in with pieces of strange wreckage and stuff, if he already knew that there was a crash saucer out there. Anyway, it was a lot of elaboration on a story that didn't make any sense. And also, the people that owned the property said there was no way you could get out there in a vehicle until 10 years later. The only way to get there was by horseback. This was 10 miles off the main road near gullies and fences and scorpions and rattlesnakes and, you know.
All the good stuff.
Yeah, and in the middle of the night, you wouldn't do it. And on top of that, anybody who's ever looked at how they handle crashed aircraft knows that you've got to get pictures of the stuff in place, you know, so you get a better handle of what went on. Why is this over there? Which way are the flaps on an airplane or the tail or the landing gears or whatever?
Right, they wouldn't be moving it immediately.
No, what's the point? I mean, you know. So 3 years ago at a meeting with Frank at his house, mind you, by invitation, and there were three other people there, he asked me, I mean, I asked him, did you go out with Blanchard? No. Did Marcel go out with you? No. So he admitted he had lied.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly it's a big surprise. I published that in the paper 2 years ago, mind you. So, you know, the story, it could have been a lot worse. It could have been better.
Yeah, and now let me ask you, since you're the premier researcher on this, I think, anything new developing around this 1947 crash after all these years, or have we pretty well explored everything?
No, one thing I wish they had done on the program was give a number. If you know anything, call this toll-free number. You know, I instigated an unsolved mysteries program back in 1989, and it was seen by 28 million people. This one was seen by fewer than 4 million, but we got all kinds of calls from people. Most of which were worthless, but some of which were very good. And I'm working now on about 4 stories from people who say, you know, my grandfather told my uncle and me that he saw the bodies, that sort of thing. They did have 2 people on the show, totally new witnesses. One who claims to have seen pictures at Biggs Air Force Base, which was
down in south El Paso, right?
Yeah, right outside El Paso.
Mm-hmm.
And the other guy supposedly was at the base, but they didn't spell his name. The first guy was Mo Cox, but the second guy, something like Newley or Newling. I have a list of all the people who were in the base yearbook, and he's not on it, which doesn't prove anything, but, you know, it would be nice if he were.
Yeah.
And so
it proves that maybe he got there too late for the picture.
Well, yeah, that one of the people Frank talked about had left the base before the event took place.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are new things going on, and I think that the climate is right for somebody to run a letter, you know, in 1,000 newspapers, anybody who knows anything, please come forward. We're racing the undertaker, you know, and Carl Flock's approach to this is to use character assassination. In his book, he dismisses Colonel Blanchard because he was a loose cannon. You know, the guy had 4 promotions from colonel to 4-star general, mind you.
And yeah, they wouldn't put a loose cannon in charge of the atomic bomb wing.
Well, yeah, he, as a matter of, well, but on top of that, he became Inspector General for the Air Force. He was Vice Chief of Staff. For the Air Force, he was head of operations. That's when he died. He was director of operations for SAC with those multi-megaton bombs under his command. This is a loose cannon? I mean, I have trouble with that. You know, I know there were people who didn't like Butch. I talked to the guy who flew the Enola Gay to drop the first atomic bomb, Tibbetts.
Mm-hmm.
I had him sign a book. He and the Navigator and Bomber were in a at the roundup, a reunion of the people in Utah. And I asked them about Butch Blanchard, and he didn't like him because Colonel or General LeMay was almost ready to replace Tibbetts with Blanchard.
Mm-hmm.
So there was rivalry there. But that doesn't mean he was a loose cannon, for God's sakes. And 3 other key people Carl attacks. One of them was a guy named Pappy Henderson, who, after seeing an article in a newspaper in 1980, told his wife that he'd always wanted to tell her, but it was classified. Now it's in the newspaper. He flew some of that wreckage to Wright Field. And he also, she was on the Unsolved Mysteries show, and another buddy of Pappy's called her afterward, and I talked to him, and Pappy had told him the story. Pappy was a squadron commander in World War II, 50 missions over Germany. That's pretty good stuff. And Pappy had shown him a piece of the wreckage. Well, Carl says, well, he was a well-known practical joker, and that was just a piece of a V-2 rocket that he had. Well, I had talked to most of his family. They all knew about the V-2 rocket. I also talked to his World War II bombardiers, to whom Pappy had told the story at one of their reunions. He was one of his pallbearers. I mean, they were close. And he had no doubt that Pappy was telling the truth. And Major Marcel, well, he buys into some hokey baloney stuff put out by an East Coast researcher who knows all about government documents but has never been to an archive. And Dr. Rudiak, who did this nice work with the Ramey memo, had shown that his portrayal of Jesse Marcel was nonsense. Just look at the record, you know. And so Carl just buys into it. And so I get a little disgusted when people take, all these guys are dead, you understand, so nobody can sue for libel. You can't libel a dead person. That's the way the law is.
Mm-hmm.
You can say almost anything you want, and nobody can sue you, because he doesn't have a reputation to lose, you know, anymore, I guess. So I don't like that kind of attack on stuff. You know, let's... You want to say Frank Kaufman is a fraud? I agree with you. I've been saying it for years.
Mm-hmm.
So the show probably did some good. After all, you don't do a show like that for aficionados like me, you know, people who are involved and so forth. You do it for the general public. And I had a number of people tell me that they found it interesting. They liked Rudiak's work. Now, the archaeology, which was the focus of the show, I thought was pretty worthless. They got 66 lunch bags of dirt that they put in the bank vault.
Yeah.
But they didn't find anything. You know, what did you expect to find in the first place? How do you know you're at the right location? I'll tell you when you're out there. It all looks the same. 10,000 square miles of...
The same. Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
And nobody had a GPS on this, you know.
Yeah. We're talking with Stanton Friedman, and we're talking about the Roswell incident. How many books total? Just do the two on Roswell, or?
I've only done two.
Uh-huh.
There have been at least, let me see, Phil Klass did one, Cal Korf did one, Carl Flock did one, all published by Prometheus Press. Three anti-books. And then... Sailor did one, somebody else did one, Cherokee did one. There's at least a dozen books out about Roswell, a very varying quality, I might add. And, you know, a lot of armchair theorist stuff, including from the academics, which rather surprised me. I expected them to do a better job.
Expect them to be a little more open-minded?
Yeah, and a little more careful.
Uh-huh.
I mean, one of them, a professor of history at University of Utah, says the only evidence we have, after all, is the three articles in the Roswell paper. What? You know, there were articles, the story grew all day long, and there were articles in much bigger papers because, you know, the press back then, this is pre-television, basically, the press back then would make telephone calls to the town to get the latest scoop, and the Wire would put out several stories in the same day.
Yeah, I'm not quite that old, but I do remember I was still going on when I first got into broadcasting. You know, it just wasn't one little story like they post now on the Internet, and that's it. But back then, it was a continuing work in progress.
All day long.
And I think on our website we do have some other papers posted about UFO, about the Roswell headlines, and one of those was the Chicago Sun-Times, right?
Daily News.
Daily News, okay.
Yeah, front page. I mean, you know, we're talking right up there. This isn't a little article in the back. But as the day grew longer, these articles got bigger because originally all they had was the press release put out by Walter Haut. So they ran with that. It went out around noon, New Mexico time, so obviously too late for all the morning papers in the country.
It seems to me that regardless of what the government says, you can't, you know, argue with the fact that they thought out there in New Mexico and Roswell at the Air Force Base that this was important enough to release a press release. I mean, they were proud of it, right?
Well, not only to release the press release, but to send a B-29 with Major Marcel and several other people in some of the wreckage that had been brought back the night before, actually, off to Fort Worth on their way to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. By the time they got to Fort Worth, the fix was in. And the other man in the picture was General Ramey, Colonel Thomas Jefferson Dubose, whom I located and spoke to in person. He was a retired general by then. He told me, standing 3 feet away from me, that he took the call from Ramey's boss, General Clements McMullen in Washington, head of the Strategic Air Command, acting head, actually. The head had other jobs he was doing. McMullen told Dubose, and we have Dubose saying this on tape, which wasn't used, that there were three orders he gave Dubose. They knew each other, all West Pointers here. McMullen, Dubose, Ramey, and Blanchard, all West Pointers. He told them, I want you to cover that story up, get the media off our back, I don't care how you do it. Two, I want you to send one of your colonel couriers up here today with some of that wreckage. And three, I don't want you ever to talk about it again, even with your buddy Roger Ramey. Now, I got this directly from Dubose, who only had 18,000 hours as a pilot and set up the Air Force's search and rescue teams and other little details like that. Prince of a man. And that wasn't mentioned there, but how do you refute somebody like that? He was in his 80s when he said this, of sound mind, I might add.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, West Pointer, that's pretty good credentials. And he was in the room, and he said that that wasn't the real wreckage. And so these are important things. And the Air Force report, I mean, you'd think a newspaper would have wanted a Pulitzer Prize for showing what was wrong with two large Air Force reports. I wrote papers on both of them. You know, this is the Mogul balloon explanation, which doesn't hold up at all as soon as you start looking at it. And then the crash test dummies. I really love those. You know, none of which were dropped until 6 years after the event, and all of which were 6 feet tall and 175 pounds. But that explains the bodies that people remembered in 1947. You know, pretty darn foolish if you want an honest answer to that. But the Air Force got away with it. The New York Times front page Sunday edition, upper left-hand corner. There's no better place for an article, you know, because of the way they stack the papers in the racks on Sunday.
Uh-huh.
60 column inches it went through the inside, buying into the Mogul explanation. Not one bit of effort to talk to any of the people involved with the Roswell incident, but lots talking to the Mogul guys. I mean, this is journalism? And that guy won a Pulitzer Prize for, among other things, showing that there had been secret underground tests that we hadn't heard, nuclear tests that we hadn't heard about. But he bought the Air Force story. So, you know, sometimes it's rather disconcerting when you go through this.
We're talking with Stanton Friedman, and Stanton, here on the UFO Files, I think our audience needs to know what you've been doing recently. And you received a Lifetime Achievement Award recently at Leeds. What's that all about?
Leeds University, 21st Annual International UFO Conference, sponsored by UFO Magazine of England. That's not the American one. And they had invited me to the conference. I've been over there before, and I gave a paper critiquing the Roswell critics. And, you know, it was well-received. It was a good conference, about 650 people there Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday. Saturday night, they had the gala banquet. They were giving out awards for the best video and the best book and so forth. And then, you know, I'm chatting with the people I'm with. There were about 200 people at the gala. And he says, we have one more thing. And I'm looking up, and they turn on their projector, and there's a picture of me at age 3. Which nobody else, of course, recognized,
but I did,
and I'm wondering, what's going on here? And there's a picture of me a little older, and I thought they'd gotten hold of a copy of a program that played on Canadian television, Stanton T. Friedman Is Real, because the first couple pictures were used in that. Then I saw pictures that I knew weren't in there. And so my face is turning red, and I'm wondering, what the heck is going on? And I go up there, and he says, oh, that's not it, and that's not all. And then I found out he had talked to my wife, gotten pictures of me from her, all in secrecy, and he had talked to at least a dozen researchers from all over the world and got them to say nice things about me. I don't know if he bribed them or not. And this is all on video. And so I was awarded the first ever Lifetime Achievement Award they've given out. And there was a conspiracy.
Yes.
And, you know, the funny thing is I went from Chicago to Manchester on a plane and then an hour from Manchester to Leeds in a car with one of the people who knew all about this. He never said a word.
Well, yeah, maybe he needs to go to work for the Air Force.
It could be.
Yeah.
It was a nice award. I appreciated it. And on top of it, some guy wrote a bit blurb about each of the lectures afterward, and I got 10 out of 10. Only two of us, the guy I was with from Chicago, did that. So I was well received. It was a great trip, I'll tell you.
Right. Now, the Stanton T. Friedman is real, that Canadian TV show. We've talked about that before. But if I remember correctly, there's copies of that available, aren't there?
Yeah, they can get them from me. My toll-free number is 877-457-0232. $20 includes shipping and handling. It's hot off the press. Got a nice box. Take Visa or MasterCard. And I'll always send along a list of all the other goodies that are available. They're mentioned on my website, too, I think.
We need to give that website address for our radio listeners. We have a link on the web, but let's give the website address, too.
It's www.v-j-enterprises.com/SF for Stanton Friedman page, that's all one word, SF page, .html.
Okay, as I said, we have a link to that too, so people can find that. Can't remember that.
It's a long one.
No, well, then go to jerrypippin.com and click on in fact, this week's shows, and you'll find it. And we also have it under previous guests. I want to take a break, and when we come back here, I want to talk to you about something happening here that involves a huge owl, or a meteor, or a monster.
Oh, the Flatwoods Monster case. Yeah, that's a hot one.
Yeah, I want to find out about that when we come back.
Yeah.
Okay, hold on.